Okay, Parshas Bo, as the name of the Parsha indicates, come with me into a fascinating Parsha, which is crucial to our national and spiritual identity, and there's a lot to talk about. And as you know, our agenda for this year is to focus on the Second Aliyah, and we for sure have to do that because there is quite a lot in the Second Aliyah to discuss. But outside of it, we just have two other points from the Parsha that I want to focus on for a moment because of their relevance to our entire year's Limud and also to what we're involved in specifically right now. And of course, it's true about the entire Parsha, but two points especially to call your attention to. So one is that I had asked you to keep an eye out somewhere in the Parsha for a reference to the idea of Chavivus HaMitzvos. And that idea that we see expressed in our Mishnah that we're involved in now, in the beginning of Arvei Pesachim, where we find that we have to try to preserve the enthusiasm for matzah as much as possible. And we've been talking about to what extent is that because of something inherent to the nature of matzah as a mitzvah, or is it because of additional themes? And we saw that there might be additional themes, and that the Rambam, for example, focusing on the idea, among other things, of Chavivus HaMitzvos. And we discussed the Tshuva of the Avnei Nezer that saw that as a value that seems to apply to many mitzvos, but is something that emerges specifically from our Mishnah and from the Gemara's connected to it, that there is an idea to make sure that we have a particular enthusiasm for the matzah that would come from preserving the appetite on Erev Pesach. So we left off with the question of, is that itself really a general Torah idea, or does it have particular relevance even within Pesach? And we suggested that as we focus on liberation, as we focus on our freedom from slavery, it's crucial that we don't think that that means we're just free to do nothing. It's a hefker kind of freedom, but rather it's a focused kind of freedom, that we're happy to be free because we are going towards something and not just away from something. We're going towards the Avodas HaKadosh Baruch Hu and his mitzvos. So the theme of Chibuv Mitzvos is specifically relevant to this moment in time and to the whole theme of Pesach in a even more focused way. So we find that that does come up in the Parsha. It's a Mechilta that's referring to a Pasuk in the sixth Aliyah, actually, Pasuk Lamed Aleph. Did you find this Rashi that has this reference, quoting from a Mechilta, that here that's also in the theme of Chametz and Matzah, Vayisa Ha'am Es Bitzeko Terim Yechmatz, so they would carry the matzah, the unleavened bread that they would have, they would put it on their backs, on their shoulders. So the Mechilta asks, and Rashi quotes this, and if you have a Torah Tamima, so it gives you the Mechilta in the original, what, they didn't have animals which could carry the matzah? But doesn't anybody say that they did indeed? That this was an expression of Chavivus HaMitzvos. This was a way of showing the particular focused enthusiasm for that whole area of life and that whole definition of their mission. So the idea of Chavivus HaMitzvos here we find especially highlighted within the Yetzias Mitzrayim experience. So the idea that in addition to every other day of the year, that on the Seder night we will want to highlight that theme, perhaps reflects that as well. I also want to call your attention in terms of the themes of the Parsha to a very, very significant Beis Halevi, which also may tie in a Klolistic way, in kind of a meta way, to our entire year's Limud, and to the whole notion of Pesach, and also perhaps to the theory that connects the whole Torah, really. And the Beis Halevi comments on the idea of the question of the Rasha, and that we find that towards the end of the Parsha, V'yigadeta levincha b'yomahu le'mor ba'avarzeh asa Hashem li b'tzeisi Mitzrayim. So, and then it goes on to say, V'shamarta sa'chuka hazos. So Rashi tells us that that's the response to the Ben Rasha, that we have to emphasize that this is why we were taken out of Mitzrayim, the Karban Pesach, and it's referred to as a chukah. So the Beis HaLevi discusses why specifically is that the response to the Rasha and being identified as the chukah, what exactly is going on. And he considers that on the one hand, you might think that maybe what the issue here is that if you have somebody who's only going to focus on doing a mitzvah, is only going to respond to doing a mitzvah if he understands what it's about. So we have to tell him that no, that's not the way our religion works, that we observe the mitzvahs even if we don't understand what they're about. And this taps in to a bigger issue. We talked about this actually a little bit last year also, in some of the contexts of Maseches Chulin, where this came up, the whole question of the role of Tamei HaMitzvos and the whole mitzvah structure. And it's a very nuanced topic because on the one hand, so we want to try to understand what the mitzvahs are about, and many of the great Rishonim did focus on Tamei HaMitzvos. On the other hand, we're also told to be careful in Darshan Taimid Dekra, that we're not supposed to assume that we can make halachic distinctions based on our theory as to what the mitzvahs are about, even if we think we are pretty confident about what the mitzvah is about. And we saw a little bit the Gemara about Shiluach HaKan last year and about how we're not supposed to refer to that as rachamim and what exactly that means. The Rambam in his discussion, Mar Nevuchim and the like. So it's a fraught topic, clearly a very important topic. So here, initially, the Beis HaLevi suggests that maybe what the concern is, if you have somebody who says, I'm only going to do the mitzvos if I understand the reasoning, so that's a very problematic attitude, and you have to emphasize to him that, no, that's not the way it works. So we're not necessarily discouraging the effort to try to understand the reason, and quite the opposite. Maybe it is a major part of our Talmud Torah obligation to try to understand what the mitzvahs are about, but the great danger is in making your commitment contingent on understanding and feeling that you are satisfied with the explanation. So that's one aspect that he suggests is going on here, but then he goes on to say that he thinks it's actually more than that, and the idea that one might think that the mitzvahs are completely tied up in the reason that we associate with them, and that we could therefore say, okay, so maybe once upon a time that had to be a mitzvah, but now it's not relevant anymore, and we can forget about it. And that allows the whole Torah to fall away. The whole Torah is eternal, and the relationship between the Torah and the Tamim that we have to understand, is kind of a, to use a favorite term here, is kind of a synergistic relationship. That, yes, there are Tamei HaMitzvos that we are given and that we come to understand, but it's kind of a circular situation that the mitzvah existed before the Tam, and the Tam exists together with the mitzvah. So here also, the idea that we have an obligation to eat matzah on Pesach, so yes, we do that because of what we read about in this week's Parsha. We do that because the Jews didn't have time to bake full bread on their rush out of Mitzrayim, so we remember that experience with matzah, but we also know that matzah predates, and that we have a tradition that Avram was eating matzah on Pesach long before they were in Mitzrayim, before his descendants were in Mitzrayim, and that was what he was eating when he was visited by the Malachim. So we have a understanding that there was matzah before there was a shibud in Mitzrayim and before there was a geula. So the Torah predates all of the reasons, and yet the reasons are also connected to helping us understand the mitzvah. So there is a synergistic relationship there that we have to appreciate. And in a sense, that really is relevant to our whole relationship with halacha, that we have to commit to it a priori, we commit to it beforehand, but that doesn't stop us from trying to explore and understand what the mitzvos are telling us. But that exploration is an eternal process. It's endlessly deep. And it can't lead us down a path where we decide, okay, it doesn't matter anymore. This isn't relevant. This isn't something that we're going to accept if we don't fully understand it. We have to have the chukah commitment to the Torah as a whole while still pursuing the effort to try to understand it as fully, as completely as our intellect allows us to do. So that circular synergistic relationship really is relevant to the whole Torah, and it's relevant especially to what we are commemorating on Pesach, and this moment of our nation's birth, it's a particularly crucial theme. So this is also part of what we're finding with matzah and chametz. And then again, matzah is significant because it's not chametz, and chametz has whatever negative imagery is associated with it. But matzah also is what reflects the time of the Yetzias Mitzrayim, the Chipazon, and therefore we also eat matzah because it is commemorative of this moment, of this time in history. But it's also got its inherent themes, and that's why HaKadosh Baruch Hu worked it out that that should be a part of what happens in history. So we have this circular, synergistic relationship with everything, but matzah represents it maybe even more powerfully than everything else. And our relationship to matzah, both as the non-chametz and as something which is inherently valuable and inherently of a message to us, is reflected by this theme. So this is something that is going to come up again and again, and therefore it's a particularly important notion and maybe really ties together our whole Masechta and ties together a lot of what we're discussing. So one of the many important themes in the Parsha. Okay, so with that, we still have to focus on our second Aliyah, which has so much as well to talk about. So let's turn to that specifically. So we find that now, the Parsha is called Bo. It's often pointed out that the Gematria Bo is 3, one of the simpler Gematrias that we have in the world, and that also gives us a little bit of a clue as to the content, because the last 3 Makos appear in Parsha's Bo. And that's actually even more significant than it may seem, beyond the Gematria. First of all, the idea of breaking up the Makos into sets of 3 or 4 is particularly relevant here. It's a little bit off, but it's a very significant message in of itself. And the idea of these Makos specifically in this Parsha has a lot to tell us as well. So we start off with the theme of Arba, with the locusts that come and devastate the crops of the Mitzrim. And there are a lot of interesting things to point out about how exactly this is presented. And it also goes to some very central themes in the Makos as a whole, and in our development as a nation, and in what we are trying to assert and what we're trying to refute. What is the message we're trying to bring about, and what is the message that we're trying to contradict? So one of the things that is unusual about this Makkah, as the Ramban and other Mefarshim highlight, is that generally, so we find that the earlier Makos, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells Moshe first what's going to happen, and then he brings that warning to Paro. So here, Moshe does tell Paro what it is that's coming, but we don't find that HaKadosh Baruch Hu told him beforehand, that he specified that this is what was happening. So how exactly did he know what it was? So it's already interesting that he doesn't seem to be told. The Chassam Sofer has a fascinating idea that maybe he was actually given the authority, given the autonomy to decide what the Makkah would be, and that was what then transpired. So Moshe said it's going to be Arba, and then God says, okay, so it's Arba. But others in the Rishonim, you find the idea that maybe the Das Kanim notes that he saw that on his makel, he saw that on his stick, were the simanim that we know from the Haggadah that breaks up the Makos into 3 groups with Rashi Tevos. So he was able to figure it out from there. So as the Ramban and others note, that one way or another, it's certainly unusual that either he had to figure it out Beremiza, or he had to figure it out some other way, but it's not explicit in the text that Moshe is being told what exactly this Makkah is supposed to convey. So there are many suggestions about how exactly this conveys a unique message. There's a sefer we mentioned a few weeks ago, a contemporary sefer called Sheish Mashzar. He has essays on themes of the parsha overall, and he highlights the grouping here, especially if you understand that Moshe was able to figure it out from the way it was grouped in the Simanim and the Makel, all the more so. But the idea that these groups have messages each of their own is something that the Ramban also talks about. This is a major theme of the Haggadah. And the idea being that the three sets of Makos were to establish three stages of a message. That the first set was to establish that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is present in the world, clearly something that the Mitzrim did not appreciate. Then the next set, his Hashgacha on the world, his providence over everything that happens. And this last set, in a more focused way, that he controls everything in nature and that nothing in nature is able to stymie him or is able to stop him. HaKadosh Baruch Hu has complete control over it. So if the idea is, okay, three themes, so we could have had three makos. So why ten? So as he notes, the idea of three is a concept of chazaka. We know that we want to reinforce something, so we try to sometimes do it in threes, chut hamasholosh. That's what gives something strength and emphasis. So okay, so then let it be nine, three, three, and three. So how come here we have four? So he suggests that within this last set, Arba is a little bit the odd man out. Arba is a little bit of a different nature than the others, because in a way that's different from all of the other Makos, Arba is really something that could happen naturally, something that happens from time to time. And yet, here it's being directed in a way that is meant to convey a Kadosh Baruch Hu's clear involvement. So it's much less unusual than all the other things that happened in the Makkah, much less of a miracle, so to speak, of a negative miracle. But in a sense, that's the point, that this is now, once we've established all of these other elements, so now it's necessary to help Paro to understand and to help the Mitzrim to understand that they who worship nature as its own force, to understand that even when nature is doing something which is not overtly miraculous or supernatural, it's still under the control of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And this is the inverse of the positive relationship that we have to Nisan, and that's certainly a big part of our focus. And as we mentioned, that Pirsumei Nisa, as we're looking towards Purim, so themes of Pirsumei Nisa are very much at the forefront. But on a Daraisa level, the idea of Pirsumei Nisa is really going to be connected to Pesach, the whole idea that we need to call attention to miracles. And the Ramban in Parshas Bo, not over here, but later in Parshas Bo, the Ramban emphasizes that it's crucial that we appreciate that everything is a miracle, that even that which seems like it's happening naturally is happening at the direction of the Ribbono Shel Olam, that that's absolutely vital to relate the whole Torah, Ramban says in very strong language. And therefore, the supernatural helps us to appreciate that the natural is also supernatural. So too, this is what the Sheish Mashar develops, that when we have this idea of Arba as Amaka, it's fulfilling that role to particularly highlight that all of these things that are happening, they're all happening at the direction of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, even that which, okay, does happen from time to time, and maybe you would have thought is not necessarily as overtly miraculous. And so therefore, perhaps the idea is that this one, Moshe, was able to figure out, or maybe if you want to combine it with the Chasam Sofer, was able to figure out the kind of category, at least, that it was distinct from the earlier Makos, which were Chidushim, which were things that Moshe would never have been able to guess. There were things that were completely out of nowhere. While here we're talking about something which is a more Al Pitar Chateva, so therefore it has a different nature to it. As far as the more specific imagery of the destruction of the crops, so the Tana de Belio, which the Torah Tamima brings and others bring, tell us that this was Mida Keneged Mida, because the Mitzrim instructed the Jews to plant their crops for them. So therefore, perhaps the idea is that that's being deprived for them, it's being taken away because this was something that they forced the Jews to provide. And that's also an aspect, as some point out, specifically of Kfiyas HaTov, because here Yosef fed the Mitzrim, and here his descendants, instead of getting free sustenance for life, are being forced to provide the food again for the Mitzrim. So that's a lack of Hakaras HaTov, and that gives it a particular intensity. It's also worth highlighting that when we talk about slavery, and we talk about the damaging effects of slavery, and especially also, you know, this past week was Martin Luther King Day, and the history of slavery in America, so it's also important to appreciate that, you know, one might think that, okay, slavery is driven by economic considerations, so the idea to get free labor, but the truth is, it's dehumanizing in a way that contradicts its economic value and shows that it has something that degrades the soul in a more powerful way. And that if we trace the path of Avdus in Mitzrayim, so it's something we sometimes forget. So you might think, okay, the Mitzrayim took the advantage of having the free labor of this Jewish population, but the Psukim are explicit in the beginning of Parshas Shmos that this was Davka put in as a way to stop the growth of the Jewish people and to keep them down and to diminish their power as a force. Now, if it was purely an economic asset, so you might think, okay, you'd want them to have a lot of children, you'd want them to have a lot of people to provide more labor. But the Psukim are clear that this was Paro's way of keeping them down. And that's what also the Tana de Beliyahu said, that the purpose of putting them to work in the crops was to keep them from engaging in puravut, to keep them from reproducing. And it reflects the fact that there is this dehumanizing aspect of avdus, which even outweighs whatever economic benefit the enslavers feel that they might get. And that's a very powerful point to reflect upon as well. Rashi comments here in Pasuk Yudalid that the idea of the Arbe, that there really were many different types that could exist, but here it was only one type that was sent. And why should that be? Why is that a part of what's going on here? So there are some who discuss this, if we're called Minchas Aharon al Torah, has a discussion about this, that this perhaps is relevant to the idea that the Ramban emphasizes in the name of Rabbeinu Chananel, that after this Makkah, so throughout the rest of history, so no other Arbe ever ate up the produce of Mitzrayim. The Rabbeinu Chananel writes that the tefillah that Moshe offered on behalf of Paro was effective not just for then, but for all of history. So it never happened again that the crops of Mitzrayim were consumed by locusts. So why is that? So the Kliyokar, it sounds like the Chote Nisker, they get this free deal forever that, okay, they had to go through a bad patch then, but then for the whole rest of history, they're protected from this vaccine, right? They're inoculated for the whole rest of history. They have now a protection against ever getting hit by this again. Why should they have that benefit? So the Kliyokar writes that because this way the future generations will also have to explain, oh, why is this never happening here? It's happening because once upon a time, this was a message that our ancestors need to receive, and we want to emphasize how unusual that is, and how that is a plan of a Kodesh Baruch Hu directly, so this is perhaps the other half of it. So it's something that could happen naturally, so it stops happening naturally in order to emphasize that then it happened specifically with this target in mind. So he suggests that Minchas Aharon, so if that's the case, okay, so then we don't want to give them too many different types of problems in this category, because then it's too much protection, too much Chote Nisker. Okay, so this very specific type of Arbe, so that's what they were protected from for the rest of their history in order to make this point. The Sfarim also emphasize that, you know, it seems a little unsettling the way it's described in the beginning of the parsha, hisalalti, this is something that we're going to kind of mock them, we're going to make fun of them, it's not the midah that we normally encourage. But the idea is, again, if we're trying to contradict specifically a philosophy and a view of the world here, that nature controls everything, and we need specifically to undermine that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the one controlling nature, so therefore it becomes particularly important to refute that perspective. And that's what the Psukim suggest that we are also emphasizing here. It's also interesting that, one more point about the Smaka. So the Pasuk also says that, in Pasuk Yizayin, that Paro requests that Moshe daven to get rid of this, and he uses the phrase that he should take off in the Yosem Me'alai Rakes HaMavis Azeh, just this death. So why just this? Why that language all of a sudden? So the Torah Tamima here has an interesting interpretation. Sounds a little bit like it maybe is giving Paro too much credit for this interpretation, but he makes reference to a Gemara Masachas Tainis and of Chesamar Aleph, where the Gemara says that in the days of Rav Shmuel Bar Nachmeni, so they had Dever there also, and they also had famine. So they wanted to know what to daven for. So the idea being, it explains that it sounds a little bit of a chutzpah to ask for too much. You don't want to push your luck. So you want to focus on one problem to daven for. So they decided to daven for the famine to end, because the understanding being of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is providing sustenance for us, so presumably he expects us to live in order to be able to use up, to benefit from that sustenance. So maybe one would also cover the other. So here he notes that there's an idea that the Dever was actually around together with the other Makos as well. So if they were dealing both with Dever and Arba at the same time, and Arba is essentially about famine because it's demolishing all the crops, it's taking away everything that they would have been eating. So if this idea from the Gemara and Tainus is correct, that you should focus on the famine because that will then connect to there being a reason to live, spiritually speaking, and that will address the other problem also. So maybe that's what he meant. Again, it sounds a little bit like maybe that's giving too much credit to Paro to have that whole kind of mentality, but that's what he suggests is perhaps a part of the message here. So with that, we go to darkness. We go to Choshech, fade to black. So the idea of Choshech is a very complex and philosophically challenging idea. And we find that it's one that is very debated. What exactly is the nature of darkness? So here we have a little bit of synergy, or Chazar synergy, because if you recall from the very beginning of the Masechta, from Daf Gimel, so the Gemara takes up that issue of the creation of darkness, and we discussed a little bit then, and it's relevant here also, that it's hard to understand. The Siv has a comment over there in the beginning of the Masechta on Daf Gimel, that the idea of creating darkness, what does it mean to create darkness? Darkness is the absence of light. So you don't have to create anything to have darkness. All you need is to not have light. So light is the creation. But without it, so then you have darkness automatically. So the idea that darkness is something more significant and something more in and of itself is a interesting idea that was a challenge to some of the Mefarshim to discuss. Remember, and my brother has a sharp sense of humor. I remember once when we were kids, we ended up going to somewhere for Shabbos, and we ended up staying at someone's house unexpectedly, and it wasn't the plan, and there was some issue. There was a light on the room. There wasn't a light on the room. We were talking about various shilas of benefiting if the light had been turned on before. I forgot the exact details, but we were talking theoretically what would happen if I wanted to sleep in the room and the lights weren't off, or if the lights were turned off on Shabbos. I forgot the exact question. But my brother suggested that we should just sleep next to the window and we'll use the dark from outside. So that doesn't really work, because you assume that the darkness is not an active thing. It's something that just exists by absence and you can't bring it in from somewhere else. But here we do find some languages of creation by darkness, which is itself interesting. But however you relate to that as a whole, so it seems to certainly be the case when we talk about the darkness of Makash Choshech, that the Choshech that they experienced certainly seems to be a creation of itself that has its own substance to it, and a very powerful kind of dark that's scary in a unusual way that's different from the way people are usually scared of the dark. And there is a comment of the Torah Tamima over here, and we had a little bit of a discussion on the chat this morning about the Sefer Torah Tamima and the various levels of its value. So there are some who are suspicious of the Torah Tamima, and apparently this is the reason, that there's a controversial comment that the Torah Tamima has in this week's Parsha on this particular pasuk, talking about Choshech. And it's a comment which apparently has provoked a lot of controversy. And I've been told that those who don't like the whole Sefer Torah Tamima, they don't like it because of this. So it's interesting. What does he say over there? That he says himself that Lulei de Mistafina, that I'm a little afraid to say this, but I want to suggest a big chiddush. So what's his big chiddush that was so controversial? It says that if you see the Midrashim, when they talk about this darkness, not only is a creation, which itself is something that we need to figure out, but that it was thick, that it was thick as a dinar. So what does it mean to have thickness to darkness? Darkness is a absence of light. Even light we can't feel. So what does it mean to have darkness that has some kind of measurable thickness? And also, he says that the idea that it was dark for days, so that changes Sidrei Bereishis, and we have a psukim that indicate that that doesn't happen, that the Sidrei Bereishis are going to remain constant. So how are you going to all of a sudden have the whole world turn, or have the sun, what exactly does it suggest? So he wants to offer a suggestion that, he says tentatively and a little anxiously, that maybe this was a substance that stuck to the eyes of the Mitzrim, that basically it was like a cataract, as some have translated it, that it was something that was on their eyes, but it wasn't actually darkness in the sense of the rest of the environment changing. And so the idea that it was relevant to the Mitzrim and not relevant to the Jews. The Jews were able to see and the Mitzrim couldn't see. So we could understand that also, together with some of these other questions, because it was something that affected their eyes and not the environment that was out there. So it's interesting that this is considered so controversial. It's not immediately clear what should be so problematic about it. I saw that in the Sefer Otzer Plos HaTorah, so he quotes it with very great excitement. This is a tremendous chiddush, that this could be the pshat. He didn't seem to think it was controversial. So I was a little curious about how and why it's considered to be so controversial. So I tried Googling it. I Googled Torah Tamima and cataracts and the Choshech and darkness. So I found a few things, a lot of people quoting it not so controversially. They were all happy with it. But I saw one interesting drasha. So we have some representatives from London here. So you'll probably be familiar with the name of Rabbi Belovsky from Golders Green. So he's a prominent rav in London. It was mentioned for the chief rabbi position last time around. And if you watched the Levaya of Rabbi Sachs, Zichron Levracha, he was one of the Maspidim at Rabbi Sachs' Levaya. So he has a drasha which he published online, that he talks about this Torah Tamima, and he talks specifically about the idea of it being controversial. That's actually what a lot of the drasha is about, and why should it be so controversial? And it actually ties in to the other themes that we've been talking about today, that what people didn't like about it was that it seems to minimize the miraculous aspect. That to say, well, maybe it was a cataract, so that's something which, similar to what we're saying about the Arba, that this is something, okay, that could happen. And therefore, so that seems like a minimizing of the miraculous nature of the text, which is a discussion in Rishonim in general, the position of the Rambam in many cases, that it was a discussion in Rishonim that, yes, obviously we believe in Nisim. That's the whole point of so much of what we're talking about today and this year and the Rambam that we mentioned before. But when the Torah describes something which is miraculous, so then, okay, if it's a clear nace, it's a nace. But if there's a way to interpret it in a way that's a little bit more consistent with Al-Pidar HaTeva, so some of the Rishonim, the Rambam specifically, have a tendency more in that direction. So the idea that the Torah Tamima was interpreting it in a way that seems a little bit more natural, so that seems to be, that's where Blavsky was discussing it, as a part of what engendered so much controversy. But again, it's really consistent with what we're discussing here and the whole theme of the Makros, and especially what we're just saying about Arba. So it actually fits well with that idea, that it's a continuation of that idea. And also, especially, as he points out, that even if you want to say that it's cataracts, but the idea that only the Mitzrim would all of a sudden develop these cataracts and all the Jews wouldn't, to say that that's any less miraculous, that it's any less reflective of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's direct providence, of course, that's itself very hard to imagine. So it's another fascinating component, and again, it's consistent with a lot of what we are looking at specifically within this parsha. Also, the idea that it was a substance that had this effect on people's bodies. So already the Ralbag said this, something Yotzer Plus Torah talks about as well, that the Ralbag understands that because it was this substance that harmed the bodies of the Mitzrim, that they had to cover up their mouths and their nostrils, because otherwise the darkness would have gone inside and would have killed them. So that added to all of their anguish. There's so much you can already imagine about just how difficult this makir was, but also to have to cover up their mouths and their nose made life even more difficult for them. Now, obviously, if the Rabag is correct, so they couldn't cover it up completely because they have to breathe, so presumably they had to cover it up to some degree while still being able to breathe. But if you say it was thick like a dinar, so I guess that's something we can conceive of. Now, of course, this is something that we relate to all the more so right now, because the idea of having to wear masks and having to cover our mouths and nose while still maintaining our ability to breathe, but having to keep out things that are smaller than a dinar, so we can certainly relate to this. But that's also a part of the relevance and the impact of this whole makkah, to think about the message that it has for us today, that happens to be an interesting overlap. And in another sense, there is also a message to our times that we should reflect upon when thinking about the darkness. And there are many ways in which we can understand and we can relate to how this is a horrible makkah and how this is a horrible thing to have to endure, that everything that comes along with darkness and this inability to move and this feeling of terror, and of course isolation, as many emphasize, and the idea that you couldn't be connected to anyone else and you couldn't interact with anyone, even if they may be physically very close to you, but you're isolated and unable to see them and unable to connect. So we don't need to be convinced that this was a terrible makkah. We can understand the enormous negativity that's associated with this makkah. And indeed, so there's a medrash that suggests that the makkah, that the choshech that this makkah had, where did it come from? Again, if we're saying it's a substance, so what was it drawn from? So one opinion the Medrash says, Michoshcha shol Gehenim, that it comes from the darkness of Gehenim. And again, okay, that's something that makes sense. It's clearly a horrible experience and connected with themes of onesh and suffering. So to associate this choshech with Gehenim, that's not such a surprise. That's not such a leap. But there's a drasher by Lam Zichrono Livracha, as we're still in the year of Avelus for him, by Lam, in one of his drashos that was published from 62 years ago, from 1959, Rabbi Lam notes that the Medrash has another opinion, that it comes not from Gehenim, but Michoshcha Shol Maila, from HaKadosh Baruch Hu's darkness, refers to a pasuk in Tehillim. So how do we understand that? How do we understand that there's a good side to this choshech? You can understand the bad side. That didn't take a lot of explanation. But what's the heavenly aspect, the godlike aspect of this choshech? And he went on to discuss in this drasha that very often we are crowded out from the stimuli of the world, that all of the noises and all of the sounds that are constantly acting upon us make it very hard to be reflective and to be creative and to be introspective. And there is an advantage to solitude also, that we need to be able to be alone with ourselves to a certain extent in order to become the people who we need to be and in order to be able to reflect and to grow. And sometimes the world makes that very hard. So there is an aspect of solitude which is positive and which is necessary. And even in the context of the makkah, you can understand that, because if the purposes of the makos were to drive introspection and to drive self-awareness among the Mitzrim. So then there is that aspect as well. And it has a positive value, not that we should look for this kind of darkness, but the idea of having some level of solitude and some level of separation from the stimuli of the world is something that has value for us. Now, if you think about the fact that Balaam gave this drasha in 1959, before there was Twitter and Facebook and the internet and everything else that's pulling us into constant engagement and constant provocation and response, and how much more so this is relevant to our door, and how much more so this is something that we need to work to preserve. So if it was hard to preserve that valuable solitude 60 years ago, you can only think about just how challenging it is for us today, especially given that we need to rely so heavily on technology over these months in order to do what we need to do. So the initiative that's necessary in order to preserve our ability to introspect and to create and to connect with our inner selves is something that we need to work very hard to preserve. And that's also one of the enduring messages of the Makkah of Choshech. And we'll just also mention one more point, which is also relevant to this, that here, so the Torah describes in Pasuk Chaf Aleph that this darkness was cast upon them, v'yomesh choshech. So what does that word mean, v'yomesh? So Shamshon Rafal Hirsch, with his typical skill for focusing on etymology and the nature of words, so he notes that this is a word that actually contains what seems to be contradictions. And the way it could be translated, if you need to go for a translation, okay, so the Choshech made them do this, made them reach out, made them grope, essentially. And the way Rav Hirsch explains it is that, on the one hand, mashmesh is to touch something, is to feel something. But, on the other hand, the word also, in other contexts, means its opposite, means to go away. Yamush. So, which is it? That touching is to come in contact, and to go away is the opposite of touching. So, how could the word mean both opposites? So, he suggests that that's exactly the point, that it can also mean, in this kind of a context, the kind of touching without touching, that basically groping, that they're feeling, but they're not actually connecting with anything. And that sense of isolation, that and of inability to change it, is a part of what this Makkah is highlighting. And it also has relevance to our modern era, where we're at once so much in contact with the whole world, but also we can be even more isolated despite all that context, that sometimes it's very illusory, that we think that we are actually with people when we're not with people. And that's a part of what's been intensified over the course of this international Makkah of this past year, and it's also something that we reflect upon and try to learn from. So just as the Mitzrim, Havdil, I guess, you know, we don't want to compare ourselves to them, but just like the Mitzrim had to go through these terrible experiences with the hope that they would reflect and learn from them and take away a enduring message, so too we have had to deal in a different way. We've had to deal, the whole world has had to deal with tremendous challenges over these months, but the hope is that we can also extract certain messages from that experience and certain lessons from what has been sharpened and what has been highlighted for us, and that we hope to come out of it a wiser experience. So I will wish you all a wonderful, enlightening, and inspiring, safe and healthy Shabbos, and please pay careful attention to the parsha. Give extra time to the Shnayim Mikra this week because of so many reasons, but also its relevance and its impact on everything that we're learning this year in Maseches Pesachim, and of course Pesach being such a central event in the formation of our nation and our value system and our mission. So there's a lot to reflect upon through a careful attention to this parsha. So hopefully you'll have time over the course of Shabbos to consider some of these themes and to listen carefully to Kriya Sator and to what you can glean from it. And I look forward to seeing you all on Sunday. You should all have an inspiring Shabbos.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you. Thank you. Have a great Shabbos. Kol Tov.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you. Have a great Shabbos.